This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I wanted to say at the start, when I was working on my book, that what became this book, Words to be Looked At, Language in 60s Art, Akanji's work was really one of the things that sort of got me started on that project. The project is this very kind of weird book in a way that looks at a trajectory of art making that starts with John Cage and people with working with musical scores and performance scores, people around Fluxus like Lamont Young and George Brecht, and sort of goes all the way through to conceptual art and Andy Warhol. And Vito is a sort of such a key figure in that, and yet I also just wanted to say in retrospect that, you know, when you finish a project, like for me, the chapter that I did a chapter on Akanji's poetry and Carl Andre's poetry, and it's weirdly one of the ones I think I'm least satisfied with, in that way that, you know how it is, the work you're closest to is often the work that's sort of hardest in some way. Okay, I want to start out today with this image, which, as you probably know, is from Vito Akanji's piece, Security Zone, performed with the artist Lee Jaffe at Pier 18 in New York in February of 1971. In this work, one of this series of sort of risk-taking, confrontational performances done in 71, Akanji places himself, as he describes it, blindfolded, ears plugged, hands tied, alone with a person I don't trust, only him to depend on to keep me from falling off the pier. Okay, there's so many different things we could say about this work, just huge numbers, from the staging of the interaction between two subjects, you know, our own position as sort of after-the-fact witnesses and viewers. I mean, there's a lot we could talk about with this piece, obviously, endlessly. However, what I want to focus on today is actually this sort of, what I want to draw our attention to today is the way that this work, like pretty much all of Akanji's early performances, operates in relation to a kind of linguistic infrastructure. And what I'm showing here is one of these typed sheets. We're sort of surrounded with them, and I've always been just completely seduced by them as texts and as objects. And part of what sort of draws me to them, I think, is their sort of marginal or liminal status, where it's not even, you know what I mean? They're not exactly works. They're something else. Some of them are published. Some of them aren't. But they're also just these sort of beautiful and evocative documents that I really, really love. And I mean, one of my own projects as someone who mostly works in the visual arts but who did a training in Comp Lit is that, I mean, I always thought the job of literary study was to look at language in all its forms, in all its places, and it's always been really disappointing to me that literary critics mostly only look at things that are in books that observe, you know, known literary genres. And to me, like, part of what's sort of rich and interesting and complicated about the art world is there's this sort of, and the world in general, is that there's this sort of endless production of textual material that, I mean, I think these things really deserve to be read as text, which is not exactly what I'm going to do today, but what I, in part, want to point to. You know, that there's this sort of rich activity in performance scores that I think is just tremendously interesting material. So this is a typed performance notation. As you can see, it's one of the ones that's actually taken from the artist file at the Museum of Modern Art, so it's got that weird little stamp and library marking, and then I love the little handwritten notation that the photos seem to belong to Willoughby Sharp is kind of great. Okay. As we know, as Akanji prepared his performances, he mapped them out beforehand with written text and often with diagrams that serve as a kind of score, written text that set up a structure to be carried out. And of course, these have a really weird status because they're not scripts. I mean, one of the things that's really interesting about Akanji's performances is that they're really not theatrical, and yet I do want to draw our attention to the fact that they do operate in relation to this weird linguistic infrastructure or linguistic score. Afterward, he typed these up along with a series of notes about the performance, recording its location, duration, and in some case, participants. These typed texts thus comprise both score and documentation. They accompany the often better known photographic, filmed, and videotaped records of the performances. And in many instances, the works would be nearly unintelligible without the information and narrative cues the texts provide. I mean, obviously with Security Zone, if all you had was the title and the photographs, you'd have no, you know, you have to in some ways have access to the sort of linguistic premises behind the work. You don't necessarily need to have known the performance notations. I mean, one of the things that he's so interested in is the way that the works live as rumor and reputation and circulate in language and become all kinds of obviously vastly different things as they do that. Okay, as you can see with this sheet here, the relation to the performance is ambiguous. The carefully notated description of materials and numbered elements comes both before and after the act and is recorded in this sort of continuous present tense. A person is chosen, we're together, I am blindfolded, and so on. This present tense retains an open-ended temporality as both record of a past enactment and a score for a future one. And that's what I'm kind of interested in with these, is that they come both before and after in different ways. And as you can see differently, here is one, this is from Pull, which was performed with Kathy Dolan. It was performed a number of times, but here's one of the textual notations for it and a photograph of one of the performances. Part of what interests me about these notations is the way they preserve the piece as ongoing, as something potentially occurring in the present. They use language to construct the work in a present tense space of encounter that, as I'm going to try to outline below, derives from and yet also departs from Akanchi's earlier work in poetry. In a series of notes Akanchi published in a 1978 catalog, he outlined a series of transitions within his performance practice from 69 to 78 in terms of pronoun relations. And I'll give you a little slide of an excerpt from this sort of I-it structure of the earliest works in which he treats his own body as a recording surface or means of action, to the gradual shift to this I-me mode in which his own presence becomes more central, you know, where he sort of works on himself as an object, and the viewer is positioned as a voyeur, to works like these that operate in an almost I-he-slash-she axis in which the viewer looks on at a scene of manipulation before then shifting to this sort of, you know, he sort of shifts to the overtly confrontational I-you dynamic in works like Claim, Seedbed, and Theme Song before he eliminates his presence altogether. And these are kind of complicated, and I'm not going to look at them too closely. Of course, the schematic mapping that Akanchi attempts here in these notes don't always hold up so neatly. I mean, if you actually look at his works, they don't obviously, you know, in terms of period shifts, these don't actually work so neatly, which is perfectly fine. I mean, obviously, but part of what's interesting to me about this is he's sort of mapping out a series of structures. But they nonetheless foreground the extent to which structures derived from Akanchi's early poetic projects, his sort of early work with language, continue to operate in and structure his subsequent performance actions and later spatial and architectural constructions. Okay. Akanchi himself has always stressed and insisted on the profound continuity between his work in poetry and subsequent artistic projects, proposing that his turn to performance was an effort to move his work off the bounded 8.5 by 11 space of the page into other types of real-life spaces. In statements over the years, and I trust that most of you are familiar with these, Akanchi has described his, quote, involvement with poetry as being about, quote, movement on a page, the page as a field of action, to use language to cover a space rather, to use language to cover a space rather than uncover a meaning. After his turn to performance, he retrospectively claimed his poetry as a precedent. Quote, I can consider that work now, in some ways, a series of scores for more current work. I consider my use of the page as a model space, a performance area in miniature or abstract form. Such comments are legendary, and indeed, part of the very difficulty of writing about or trying to think through Akanchi's move from page to performance is that his own statements are so rich and evocative, so cryptic and enlightening. At times, all we want to do is cite them and repeat them. And I think anyone who works on Akanchi has this problem, which is that he's just such a great source that you just, it's hard not to endlessly sort of defer to him. And I want to acknowledge, you know, Akanchi's own statements about his work construct a dominant reading, and it's not one that I wish to contest, because I largely adhere to it, and yet I want to sort of tease some other things out. Yet things may not be quite so straightforward. In a pretty interesting review of the recent volume, Language to Cover a Page, that republished, you know, a lot of Akanchi's early poems, the poet and critic David Anton protested the tendency to assimilate Akanchi to overly familiar polemics about suppressing the referentiality of language in favor of its more operational dimensions. And indeed, part of the difficulty of writing on Akanchi is it's just sometimes it's all too easy to seem to assimilate him to certain models. As Anton teases out, Akanchi's poems are laden with all kinds of poetic devices and even personal revelation. However inspired by the materiality and literalism of minimal and post-minimal art, Akanchi's poems also exist in relation to a series of poetic precedents and contexts. And what I sort of hope to be able to, I'm not going to actually be able to do this today, but one of the things personally I would really love to take on is really looking at Akanchi much more closely in terms of his poetic context of the time, which is the sort of transitional moment of the New York School, people like Berrigan, people like Paget. I mean, he refers to those people as his context, and I think it would be really interesting and important to actually look at him more closely in relation to those sort of poetic precedents. Anyhow, when Akanji proposes, quote, "I can consider my use of the page as a model space, a performance area in miniature or abstract form," I think we need to consider, what kind of space is the page? What types of movement are possible in it? And what kinds of subjects are constructed in these moves? Mostly written at this amazingly fevered pace between about 1967 and 1969, Akanji's poems explore a series of different possibilities. In a work like this one here, titled Re, the page resembles a game space in which parentheses of varying lengths circle around, some empty, others enclosing short snippets of repetitive text. And I might note that along with lists and numbers, parentheses are one of Akanji's favorite devices. You know, they're used to break up flows, they isolate words, they set up relations, and he often uses all these kind of markers in a completely non-function way. Like in Four Book, there's this one poem in which every section is numbered one, and then every line is numbered one. So this is sort of constant use of punctuation marks to break things up, but then the sort of often deliberate dysfunctioning of punctuation to sort of set it apart. Although we are not privy to the rules at play here, both game and page seem self-enclosed, self-referential, comprised of dictic, shifters, and short phrases that reflect back on the conditions of utterance. And you can see, you know, I say here, I do not say now, this is not to say, and so forth. In another often reproduced example, this one here, Akanji constructs the poem as an extraordinarily constricted enclosure, a present tense space of encounter in which the reader has little option but to retrace the path laid out by the page. I mean, it's just this totally weird reading experience. In their extreme reduction and literalness, in works such as these, Akanji's notion of the poem as a, quote, field for action could almost seem to be to oppose point by point the collaborative emancipatory claims of the oral poetics movement at the time. I mean, one of the things that sort of interests me is that Akanji has this very strange relationship to community, and precisely at the moment when the sort of various parts of the larger New York poetic community are really sort of emphasizing and even really fetishizing collaboration and community. I mean, all the kind of, you know, everywhere from, you know, sort of Jackson McClough and all the sort of, you know, simultaneous oral performances to, you know, the endless accounts that people like me, of course, read after coming much afterwards of, you know, the long nights at, you know, Ann Waldman and Lewis Warsh's. And, you know, you get these endless accounts of the New York School in particular as a sort of endless hangout scene where a certain notion of collaboration is endlessly sort of discussed and fetishized. And so part of what's fascinating to me about Akanji is, you know, his sort of cool, nerdy, aloof detachment from that, and the way that, you know, he really understands that language both is, but also in some profound ways isn't, a space for interaction. And I sort of love the way, I mean, this is just, I mean, I'm not sure it's the richest reading experience, but it's a really interesting, I don't know, example or device for thinking about this really sort of hyper-directed relation to language. And, you know, it's somehow not coincidental that this is being made at the same time that roughly that, you know, Bruce Nauman is doing his early corridor structures, right? I mean, obviously they're different, but there's a sort of similar interest in a kind of disciplinary, hyper-directive approach, which is understood as a kind of corrective to this sort of free-form kind of, I don't know, I don't want to call it hippie-ish, but, you know, a certain kind of 60s model that sort of sees everything as interactive, which obviously has its problems. Okay. For me, it is where Akanji's poetry intersects with his work as an editor in the pages of the magazine 0-9 that a host of the most interesting possibilities emerge. And to me, I actually find that work to be some of his sort of richest, and okay, here it is. And recently republished, the magazines exhibit Akanji's work on the page, works made with his own poetry and others' poetry. And here I'm going to talk about Akanji's role as editor. Of course, I mean, I'm very aware that Bernadette Mayer was also involved and that they sort of worked on this together, but I can't quite go into that here. Okay. For instance, here, in the sprawling prose piece On, published in 0-9, number 3, in 68, the text sprawls and unfurls throughout the magazine, jumping from page to page. Not only is it intercut with works by Guillaume Apollinaire, Aram Saroyan, John Giorno, and Clark Coolidge, but it behaves like some strange interstitial material, gathering materials as it goes. And I think you can see here the way it works, which is that there's Akanji's column on the one side, the Apollinaire, which is across the page from it. And then there's this weird this middle column, which is comprised of the last word of a Conscious line and the first word of the line across the page. So that it kind of, one of the ways, not only does this piece jump from page to page throughout the magazine, so it sort of comes in between different pieces, is that it's constantly gathering materials from other poetic works or other works that are published in the magazine. Okay. As you can see here, the words on the far left column are drawn from the first word of the line in the text across from it. On the open two-page spread, the text works visually, graphically, as much as linguistically. The strangely spiraling column of words separates and yet also joins the two columns of print, one authored by Akanchi, one not. On is not only parasitic on this context, incorporates it, while suturing itself into its magazine context. And I have to say that to me, On works as a magazine piece when it's been published elsewhere as a standalone work. To me, it falls apart. I mean, it's interesting. To me, a great deal of the interest of it is this sort of dynamic relation it has to the magazine page. And when you excise it from that, that just doesn't happen, obviously. Okay, let me give you one more example. Okay. Is it only by accident that here, where On occurs across the page from a particularly minimal poem by Aram Saroyan, that its own text is overtaken by a series of repeated letters? I mean, and I sort of love to watch it sort of break down in different places. And I mean, I think the way I'm reading it here, I mean, when you read this, you do read it first and in a dominant way, sort of visually and graphically, and then you return to the text, but it's often not always clear with some of Akanchi's poems what the role of the I mean, you do read the words and read the language, but sometimes the words and language feel important, but sometimes they feel like space holders or placeholders, that he's partly interested in them simply as material to fill space. Though, of course, on the other hand, you know, you can read them and sort of establish a reading for them. As poet slash editor, Akanchi seems to have metamorphosed from an author, the source of utterances, to an arranger, a composer, moving words around, moving type around. Increasingly, in 0 to 9, blankness, spacing, and spatial relationships come to the fore, and I think you can really see this in about issue 3 or issue 4. Words become tools, props, to stage relationships within this space. Akanchi even comments to a rejected contributor that, quote, there's too much emphasis on message here, not enough on the space of the page. And one of the things that, of course, is important to know, I mean, 0 to 9 can look so free form, but it's important to understand how much is rejected from it to make it. I mean, it has this sort of, for all its openness, this incredible specificity. And the rumor, you know, there are sort of legendary stories about all the materials that Meyer and Akanchi endlessly rejected, mostly from their sort of New York school peers. We also see Akanchi become fascinated with strike-throughs and the way that the marks both cancel and preserve text, retaining it as language while also turning it into a block. As you can see here in this cover, this is from the book, Four Book, from 1968, and you can see the cover, and there's, you know, hook, cook, look, hook, rook, brook, all crossed out, and then the title, Four Book, at the very, very end. To give you another example of the strike-throughs. Oh, here we are. In these poems that were published in 0 to 9, number 4, the strike-throughs also create a temporal relation, a sense of what came before and what came after, a binary temporality of past and present. You know, when you do a strike-through, there's a sense that there's this typing, and then there's this strike-through that happens after, so there's this way in which that creates a sort of interesting dual temporality. Yet the relation of the other, more mobile clusters of text is unfamiliar. And unlike in On, the logic and pattern of the joinings and borrowings is less predictable. Intermittently, there's a sense of ligature as the scattered middle column seems to yoke together disparate fragments. And of course, it's interesting. I mean, if you know anything about the poetry of the time, I mean, double column poems, aren't they like one of the biggest cliches of the late, I mean, everybody did them, right? Every single poet who was alive then seems to have at least done a few of these sort of poems that try the sort of double column and set up different ways of reading them. And, I mean, part of what interests me is the way that Akanchi is sort of playing off that as a style, sort of using it and not using it at the same time, which is, because these, and yet these do sort of, I mean, it's so hard to read these and talk about what they're doing because they're so visual, and they do read almost as a sort of musical thing, that there's this noise that's happening and this message that weaves in and out of it and this sort of interesting spatial relationship that is set up. And of course, the fact that, you know, what the text is saying is reading is getting at the meaning of something. I mean, there's this way in which he often sort of provides his own kind of written commentary that comments on something while at the same time he's canceling out this commentary, so sort of putting it in some sort of, I don't want to say putting it under erasure because those are a different set of terms, but, you know, he's sort of holding it at bay in certain ways. Okay. Akanji has talked about how reading the work of John Ashbery gave him a kind of permission to, quote, get it down to words, to generate a poetry about the properties of language and language play. Yet even if, in poems like Europe, Ashbery seems to push material around, treating words as so much stuff to be chopped up, arranged, scattered, and gridded, Ashbery's borrowed fragments are not just type on the page, even if a few critics at the time mistakenly thought they were. However nonchalantly, Ashbery has arranged them just so, creating these rich flashes of meaning and flickerings of resonant images. There's a constant push-pull, this sort of sense of background and foreground. I mean, anyone who's read, you know, early Ashbery, like Europe and some of the other poems in Tennis Court, or, you know, how it sort of looks like fragments of language, but as you read it, you know, these rich sort of mini-narratives do, you know how with Ashbery, like, he can't not make language beautiful? You know, it's always rich, it's always evocative, there's always hidden stories and sexual stuff and narratives that inevitably come sort of flashing through what only at first glance might look like apparent cacophony. You know, so there's always this real sort of narrative infrastructure to it, I think. Akanji's poems, for the most part, don't work that way. They're flatter, more machinic, and more spatial. His columns become walls, obstacles, boundaries. His empty pages are not a background. His texts cut, interrupt, and remove. So it's interesting to see what he draws from Ashbery, but how he also just completely goes somewhere else with it. While the words themselves are not entirely incidental, they become subordinated to these larger activities of placement, circulation, and distribution. As you can see here in this spread from 0 to 9, number 5, which shows, and I think you can see this, it's a single line. He took this short piece called Act 3, Scene 4, which he sort of famously distributes single lines from through the whole print run so that each copy gets one line. And then I sort of love that, of course, it's across the page from this really quite beautiful poem by Clark Coolidge that is, it's actually an interesting example of a beautiful but also in some ways more conventional kind of late 60s double-column poem. As Akanji famously sought to eliminate words that referred to a reality off the page, he gradually reduced language down to shifters and punctuation marks and weird, disjointed, dysfunction figures of speech. And just a quote from one of any number of interviews where he said roughly the same thing. Quote, it started to seem impossible to use a word like tree, a word like chair, because this referred to another space, a space off the page. Whereas I could use words like there, then, at that time, words that referred to my activity on the page, my acts of writing on the page. So, in fact, toward the end of time I was writing, I was driving myself into a corner, into a kind of dead end, when in order to preserve the literalness of the page, the only thing I could use were commas, periods, punctuation marks. And indeed, in a book like Transference, Roger's Thesaurus from 1969, the reading experience is pretty darn attenuated, as what's been left out so overpowers the kind of narrow column, these sort of, you know, this little column of fragmented and dysfunctioned letters and symbols that creep down the very edge of the page. And, you know, there are ways in which this is a dead end, and yet there are also ways in which it's tremendously interesting and generative and productive. Okay. All right, and I'm hopefully more or less almost at my time. Okay, what can we say about this work? And this is where I really don't have a conclusion. What can we say about this work? Partly, of course, we know. One of the things he's doing here is that the page turns into a container. It turns into this field for action and increasingly starts to link with other kinds of spaces off the page, right? This is what Vito always says, and it's, you know, true. One of the ways it's interesting, of course, to think the specificity of his project is think about, you know, there's a whole lot of other ways you can get from the space of a page to, say, the space of a gallery. You can think of it visually. You can shift from 2D to 3D. I mean, there's a whole set of different precedents for thinking that relation that makes us aware of the specificity of the way that he looks at the page as this little container, this arena for action, and then he maps that structures onto other different kinds of arenas for action. Because part of what interests me here, and that I think really differentiates him from other people working in performance at the time, is the way his work with language offers a structure and a discipline, the way it sort of sets up a series of structures and properties that really almost entirely differentiate his work from a lot of the other more improvisatory or expressionistic performance art done at the time. I mean, and obviously to me, I've written a bit at various points on the sort of event scores of people like Lamont Young and George Brecht, and the incredibly important, though I think really still in ways underknown, work that Simone Forti did in like 58, 59, 60, where she sets up these short verbal scores that then set up a whole series of interactions. And it's clear that, you know, Acconci was very, very aware of that work and sort of transferring it to a sort of different set of procedures, but using in some ways that as a model where you have a sort of textual infrastructure or score or notation that sets up a series of procedures, and then the performance is the carrying out of those procedures. So there's both a structure, but then there's also all the unanticipated, unwritten things that happen during the carrying out of the structure that are deliberately left open by the structure, which is, I think, sort of part of the beauty of the work. So I guess what I want us to think about, and I'll sort of close with a question instead of a conclusion, is how does this linguistic infrastructure continue to structure his later work? Not in the sense that sort of Craig has talked about it as kind of writing by other means, but how does language provide a structure, a series of operations that then get used elsewhere, and how can we continue to think, at least, I mean, I most more have worked on his work of the 70s, the work in performance, but also potentially the work in architecture in relation to a kind of written or textual infrastructure. So thank you.